Okay, so we left off last time. We finished Perek Zayin of Shmuel Bet, Shmuel Beis. So now we're going to begin Perek Ches, chapter 8 of Shmuel Beis. And the main theme of Perek Zayin was the fact that David wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash, and he was told that he cannot build the Beis HaMikdash. And part of his rationale, part of his thinking, why he thought to build the Beis HaMikdash is because there had been a sense of peace and tranquility in the land. When you look at the Psukim and Sefer Devarim, which talk about the actual building of a Beis HaMikdash, so, well, it doesn't, again, mention the place, it says the place that Hashem will choose, but it talks about there being peace and tranquility in the countries around. So there may be an understanding that David understood that the fact that he was not allowed to build the Beis HaMikdash is actually a sign that the peace is not a real peace and that there needs to be more war. And that David's history of being a man of war is not complete. And this, Perek Ches is going to be a lot about David expanding the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, expanding the land that he was in control of and the taxes that he would be able to charge, and expanding his empire and continuing to be that man of war who then can't be the one who builds the Beis HaMikdash, but that, you know, David seems to be okay with that idea, and we'll even see some hints to it that he uses his position as being a man of war to at least put forward the possibility of that his son will be able to build the Beis HaMikdash and that he will be involved in some of the preparations. So Perek Ches Pasuk Aleph. Vayi acharichein, it was after this. Vayach David es plishtim, vayach ni'em. That David attacked the plishtim, and he subdued them. This is not the first time that David is battling the plishtim, but this is the first time that David is offensively going into the land of the plishtim. Till now, there were pending attacks with the plishtim. We had two such attacks very close to Yerushalayim, where David turned to Hashem and said, "Should I attack? And will I be successful?" But it was that while those were, perhaps David was starting it, but it seemed like the plishtim were about to attack. Here, David is going into Plishti mainland, and David is doing the attacking. We don't see him asking the Urim and Tumim here, should he be going to war? And again, the understanding based on the commentaries is that it's because of the fact that he was told that he couldn't build the Beis HaMikdash. That's kind of like a license. Keep battling. Keep going to war. And he subdued them. It could very well be that this was a final blow to the Plishtim that finally subdued them. We had seen they had been the thorn in the side of the Jews all throughout Sefer Shoftim and Sefer Shmuel up until this point. This battle of David's really put them down. Vayikach David es meseg ha'amo miyad plishtim. David took a place called Meseg ha'amo from the hands of the plishtim. Meseg ha'amo, Rashi tells us, because Rashi is quoting from the pasuk in Divrei Hayamim. In Divrei Hayamim Aleph Perek Yud Ches is a parallel story to what's happening here, and we hear some of the details. This is a reference to one city of the Plishtim, in particular, the city of Gass. The city of Gass, if you recall, when we learned the beginning of Shmuel Aleph, there were five main Plishti cities. Some of them we know because they're popular cities today. There was Ashkelon and Ashdod. Those are very popular in Israel. There's Gaza, which is Gaza City, approximately. There was Ekron. We don't know so much about Ekron. And there was Gass. Today we don't know so much about Gass. Gass was considered to be the greatest of the five cities, and it's the only city that had a king. We had saw in Sefer Shmuel Aleph, we saw Achish, Melech Gass. That even though these were the five major cities, and each of these cities had a governor, and each of the governor was important. If you remember when the Plishtim took the Aron and then returned the Aron, they gave gifts in the number of five to represent the five Plishti cities. But Gass was considered to be the biggest of it. Rashi even uses the word, you'll be able to translate it with me, metropolitan, right? Rashi uses that, I guess the Greek kind of got in. It was the metropolis of the Plishtim, and that's this, so in Sefer Divrei Hayamim, it's described as the city of Gass, just its name. It says, Vayikach Gass uvenoseha, that David took the city of Gass and its surrounding towns. While here in Shmuel Aleph, in Shmuel Bet, it's called Meseg Ha'ama, Mesek Ha'ama translates as the translation is the harness of an Amma. An Amma, we know, we usually refer to it as a halachic measurement. An Amma, a halachic cubit, whatever that, it's the area from the elbow to the tip of the finger. An Amma means an arm. So Mesek Ha'ama, the harness of the arm, what controls the animal when you're riding an animal? The harness that you're holding in your hand, that controls the direction of the animal. What was the most important kind of town or city that controlled the direction of all Plishtim? It was Gass. And so that's the nickname of Gass. David took that. While David taking that it's a symbol of a great victory over the city of Gath. And we know that David had some history. David had history with Achish, who was the king. That was the king who allowed David to live with the Plishtim for some time. And now David is in a position to take control. And as the Pasuk notes, Vayachinim, he subdued them. This would be a much more lasting subjugation of the Plishtim. So that if the Plishtim are to the southwest, right? It's where Gaza is today. That's the land of the Plishtim. So David went in that direction and led war there. Pasuk Beis. Vayach es Moav. He also struck against the people of Moav, which are to the direct east, right, where Jordan is today. He struck against Moav. Vayimadadim bachevel. He measured the captives with a chevel, with a rope. Hashkevo tam arza, he laid all the captives down on the ground. Vayimadeid shnei chavalim lahamis umaloha chevel achayos. Some way of using rope to measure the captives, and every two lengths of rope, those captives were killed, and the third length of rope, that captive was saved. This was a execution of captives. It's in apparently a very severe way, right? Shnei chaval nahamis umla chaval achios vati Moav leDavid, and the people or the country of Moav was for David laavadim as slaves nosei mincha, who would carry offerings, meaning they would offer and bear the weight of a mincha, of a tribute, meaning all their taxes now went to David. So of those whom he captured, he killed two-thirds and kept one-third as slaves. What justified David killing these captives? What was it about? Because we're going to read, it's going to sound like the out of all the nations who David in this time period is conquering, it seems the ones who get the worst punishment is Moab. Why? So Rashi says, quoting from a Medrash, that when David was on the run from Shaul, he was nervous about his family. And so we read Psukim how he had been in contact with the king of Moab, and the Midrashim tell us he deposited his family with all of in the land of Moab, and after David left, Moab went back on his word to protect them, and Moab executed everyone from David's family except for one sibling, except for one relative. And this is David's opportunity to avenge the deaths of his family. One of the indications are that we never hear of David's family again. You would imagine, and especially if you go with the approach that they were put into hiding, so you'd imagine there'd be some type of elaborate bringing them out of hiding when David becomes king, right? When the Torah goes out of its way to talk about an elaborate, reuniting after Moshe is successful, so his father-in-law comes and joins. You'd imagine David's king, his father Yishai, and the rest of the family would come and join him to celebrate, to recognize him as king. We never hear anything from them. So there definitely seems to be, again, you can call it a silent type of proof, but there definitely seems to be some proof on the ground that David's family is no longer. And David here, fighting against Moab, is to some extent taking some type of revenge. So David went south east to the Plishtim. He went west to Moab. Pasuk Gimel. Vayach David es Hadad Ezer ben Rehov melech Tzova. David struck against Hadadezer, the son of Rehov, melech Tzova, who's the king of Tzova. Tzova is in the north. Tzova is in the north, which covers both parts of Lebanon and Syria today. And the pasuk continues and says, "Bilechto lahashiv yado b'nahar piras," which we're going to translate literally. Bilechto, as he was going, lahashiv yado, to extend his hand, b'nahar piras, against the river, or over the river Piras, which is the Euphrates River. This is a little bit strange. Who was trying to extend themselves towards the Euphrates River? There are two ways to read the pasuk. If you read the pasuk that it's the way that Rashi does, Rashi says that this king, Hadadezer, which may be a unique name, but may also be a type of title. You're going to, if you stick around for the rest of Shmuel and then Malachim, there are kings that sound very similar to that. So it might have been like a title, kind of like Avimelech is in the Plishtim. There isn't just one Avimelech in Plishtim. Avimelech is kind of like Paro is in Mitzrayim. Avimelech is in the Plishtim. Hadad Ezer and things like that are in some of the northern kingdoms. So Rashi explains that it was Hadad Ezer trying to go against the Euphrates, trying to Now here we're gonna use a map. And we're going to say Hadadezer, put on our glasses. Hadadezer is the king of a place called Hama. Hama, according to the Art Scroll, I didn't measure it on Google Maps. Hama is about 150 miles north of Damascus. The Israel that we know and love ends at about here. This little part in the corner is still Israel. So this is quite north. The Euphrates River is located here, so it's even further away from Eretz Yisrael. So if you read the pasuk that Hadadezer was trying to extend his control to the Euphrates, that would not impinge at all on the land of Israel. That shouldn't bother David at all. Which leads other commentaries to explain, the Vilna Gaon in his commentary for in Divrei Hayamim, he explains that no, it was David. David was trying to extend control all the way to the Euphrates River, and therefore on his way to the Euphrates River, now it makes sense, perhaps, because depending on where he's going to hit the Euphrates, it can make sense that he has to go through the land of Hadadezer, and that's why he's attacking Hadadezer. The main goal is with the most important cities that you ever have in a kingdom are your border cities, right? We're a little, in the United States of America, we're, you know, it seems to be we're only concerned about one border. And it's not necessarily for security reasons. It's for other reasons, perhaps. But the border in the north, no one's really concerned. You know, you could say thank God, but in a regular, I don't know if it's regular, in a hostile environment, your border cities are considered to be crucially important. The further your border is away from your mainland, so the better protection you're going to have, right? Worst comes to worst, you lose 100 miles of you know, your border, your extra land, but then your land is still safe. So David's mission to extend all the way to the Euphrates, that is to cut off any enemies from coming from the north. And the truth is, in the long run, who is it that destroys the first Beis HaMikdash? It's the Babylonians. And where do they come from? They come through the Euphrates, because Babylonia is in Iraq, over Iraq and Iran, kind of here and here. And so it's not a bit, right? Who exiles the 10 tribes? The 10 tribes are exiled by Assyria, which is also in the north. So the fact that David wanted to expand the border specifically in that northeastern direction, that actually is where the biggest threats were. The biggest threats came from there. Again, we don't know how successful, you know, David was at holding back at different times. Once there was going to be a decree that the 10 tribes had to be exiled and that the first Beis HaMikdash had to be destroyed. Okay, so then all the precautions were not there. So this pshat of the Vilna Gaon seems to make more sense. If you read the pasuk, like Rashi says to read it, it's a little challenging because just because Hadadezer is expanding in a different direction, maybe you could try to say that any time a relatively local power is trying to grow, that's a threat. I mean, even if it's not an immediate threat, if he's expanding his empire, so having a big empire next to you can be dangerous. So David struck against this to the north. Pasuk Dalet. Vayilko David mimenu. David captured from Hadadezer, the king of Tzova, Elef Ushva Meos Parashim. He captured 1,700 horsemen, the Esrim Elef Ishragli, and 20,000 foot soldiers. And here, we hear nothing about David killing the soldiers, which just goes back to highlight that he had something specific against Moab. But keeping these soldiers and enlisting them in service, that was something that David was interested in. But what's the problem? But there is a problem with the animals, specifically with the horses themselves. Vayaker David es kol harechev. Vayaker, the word akar means to uproot. Here it gets translated as a verb to, in the past, that he hamstrung the horses. By doing some type of severing with a knife or some type of implement to the hamstrings of the horses, it doesn't kill the horse, but it limits the capacity, it maims the horse, and it limits the capacity, it cannot be a battle horse any longer. Vayosrimenu me'arechev. But he left over 100 chariots. Painful for the horse. So that's a little bit of a question, right? So first we have to try to understand why is it that he's keeping the soldiers, but he's not keeping the horses. So the Torah tells us in Sefer Devarim, in Perek Yud Zayin, Parsha Shoftim, when it's talking about the idea of having a Jewish king, so there's certain commandments that a king has to keep. One of them is not to have too many horses. In the times of the Tanakh, horses represent, right? How do you tell what's a really strong and powerful car in terms of the insides? We call it horsepower. Where'd that come from? It comes from the fact that, however, horses were your tanks, horses your chariots. So if your army had 20,000 horses and your army had 40,000 and the other guys had 40,000 horses, that's horsepower. A Jewish king is not allowed to have too many horses. Why? Because they're not allowed to believe in their army. First and foremost, they're not allowed to have too many horses because God said so. But why would it be that God says so? Because Hashem always wants the belief of the Jewish king to be that, yes, I need to have some type of army, put in my efforts, my hishtadlut, to do what I have to do. But in the end, as David HaMelech writes in Tehillim, Eilav Arechev, some will win with their horses, some will win with their chariots, but we call out in the name of Hashem, and that's why we're successful. So he hamstrings the horses in order that he's not going to be able to use them. But he can't just give them back to the other side because they'll regroup and come back. He has to make the horses not usable for anyone. For himself, because he doesn't want to violate the Torah and have too many horses, which, parentheses, that ends up being one of the downfalls of his son, of Shlomo, as we'll see. But he doesn't want to give them back to the other side. Now that raises the question of what about Tzar Bala Chaim? What about the fact that he's causing unnecessary pain? Maybe we should take out that word. Unnecessary. What about that he's causing pain? So the pasuk. So it could be he was paralleling himself. There's a pasuk in Yoshua, Perek Yud Aleph, where Hashem came to Yoshua and said, "There's going to be a certain battle. You're going to end up with a lot of horses, and you should actively destroy the same language of vayaker harechav, that you should hamstring them. You should make sure that they can't go anymore. So that while, you know, again, I hope the animal activists aren't necessarily listening in.
Anyone who's hurt themselves in the gym,
right. So the idea being that Tzar Bala Chaim is when there's no need, but making sure that your enemies are not going to have weapons. The horses were weapons. That's a need. So again, sometimes there's a need that's food based, and sometimes there's a need that doesn't. It's a little bit more of a process, but that may not be Tzar Bala Chaim. So David might have been paralleling himself based off what happened in Yehoshua, that Hashem had at least one time given this as a piece of advice. So now we have, that's the third battle that David is successful in. Just at the end of the pasuk, Vayosru menu mea rechav, he kept 100 chariots. 100 chariots, there are four, the Mepharshim say there are four horses and a chariot, so he saved 400, meaning as almost a recognition of the Torah tells you you're not allowed to have a lot of horses or too many horses, but you're allowed to have some. I mean, you have to have, your army is going to have some division in the army that has chariots. And so that was David saying, I'm going to put my faith in Hashem, but I have to have something. And he's the more land you expand, the bigger your army has to be. You have to protect more. So he has to have more horses in his army. So he keeps 100 for himself. Pasuk Hey. Vatavo Aram Damesek La'azor L'hadad Ezer Melech Tzuva. Aram is another country that's north but further east. So I imagine in our map over here, it's probably somewhere around here. Like it's between Moab over here and if Tzova is up here, it's somewhere in the middle. Right, and it uses the word Damasek, which is Damascus, which most probably is the same ancient Damascus and modern, however modern, I've never been there. Damascus is about the same. So they come to help, meaning that what was the exact relationship between these two countries? I don't know if we know for sure, but if there's a common enemy called the Jews, then the king of Aram will come and help. So pasuk hey again. Vatavo Aram damesek la'azor la'hadadezer melech Bavel melech Tzova. Vayach David ba'Aram esrim ushnayim elefish. And in this battle, David was super successful. And I guess for whatever reason, he doesn't choose to capture them. He chooses to kill them, or maybe it wasn't a choice that you can only capture if you capture after the battle is over and you're left victorious. If in the course of the battle and the battle keeps going, you're just killing many soldiers, so then you're gonna be left with a count of the casualties, and it's at 22,000 men from the side of Aram. Now, why is it that it doesn't seem that Tzova? It could be they just fell in battle quicker. You're gonna have more who stay alive but are captured than who are gonna fall in the battle. Pasuk Vav. Vayasem David nitzivim ba'aram damesek. David appointed nitzivim are officers, officials in Aram. Damasek in Damascus, Vati Aram le David, and the nation of Aram was now like a nation state to David. La Avadim as servants, Nosei Mincha, again those who will bear tributes, meaning they have to pay their taxes to David, and the Nitzivim that he placed over them, they're there to make sure that those taxes get paid. They're not going to; these lands will not be independently controlled anymore. Vayosha Hashem is David, and Hashem provided, caused salvation for David, b'chol asher halach, everywhere that he went. When David did this, he, in a very large way, increased the borders of Eretz Yisrael. And specifically, the country that we call Syria today, the majority of what we call Syria today became part of Eretz Yisrael, And in the halachic literature, it's referred to as Surya. Surya, same name. Surya only had attained a quasi status of holiness. For whatever reason, David did not engage in dialogue with the Sanhedrin before going on these conquests. And therefore, this was not considered to be the king representing the country and representing the tzibor, the community, in conquering land and therefore sanctifying the land, which is what Yehoshua did when he conquered the land. It's called kibush rabim, the conquering of the many, meaning that many people are involved in the conquering. David's kibush was only called the kibush yachid. It was called the conquering of an individual. And therefore, the halachic status of Surya was to a lesser extent. It created a level of sanctity in the land on a lesser extent than mainland. So let's say the mitzvos atulios ba'aretz, the mitzvos that are dependent on the land, were not enforced to the same level in Surya as they were in Eretz Yisrael. So your truma, your meiser, are not on the same level. If they were midaraisa, if they're considered to be on a level of the Torah in the land of Israel, so Surya is a lower grade, perhaps on a level only on a level of derabanan, but it's still.
Who would want to live there if it's not this?
You're probably trying. You know, if the economic reasons. You would not be making a religious decision to live there, but you know, a certain opportunities would present itself, just like the Shvatim who decided to stay on the other side of the Jordan. Mm-hmm. They did it for economic reasons, so that it remains. Meaning, even in later years, the halachos of these areas are discussed because of what David went ahead and did. But it seems to be that David's motivation, the way the Mefarshim understand, was defensive, to expand the border in such an elaborate way to create a proper defense of mainland Israel. Pasuk Zayin. Vayikach David es shiltei hazahav. David took specifically the shiltei hazahav, which gets translated by some as arrows, by others the shields of gold. Asher hayu al avde Hadad Ezer, vayivim Yerushalayim. Apparently, the servants of Hadad Ezer, who was again the king from the north in the land of Tsova, his servants had golden shields, and David brought those golden shields to Yerushalayim. Umi betach umi berosai, are Hadad Ezer, from some of the other cities of Hadad Ezer. One called Betach, one called Beiros, or Beirosai. Lakach Hamelech David Nechoshes Harbe Meod. David took a lot of copper. What did he do with all this? So in Divrei Hayamim, we're told, just to drop more information, where it says he took Lakach David Nechoshes Rabba Meod. He took a lot of copper. But with this copper, asa Shlomo es yam nechoshes v'samudim v'sklei nechoshes. There were parts of the Beis Hamikdash that needed a lot of copper. Specifically, there was when Moshe Rabbeinu built the Mishkan, he was told by Hashem to build a kior. The kior is the wash basin where the Kohanim would wash their hands and their feet, and that was made out of copper. When Shlomo built the Beis Hamikdash, he built an additional vessel, a very, very large and elaborate vessel out of copper, and it was called the Yam. It was called the Yam because it held a large quantity of water. It wasn't obviously as big as the sea, but it was quite large and quite elaborate. And there were these two posts. One was called Yachin, one was called Boaz. Two copper pillars that were at the entrance to the Beis Hamikdash. Again, needed a ton of copper, and so this pasuk in Divrei Hayamim with other mafarshim is a hint that when David, why did he bring these golden shields to Yerushalayim? He's already starting to stockpile materials for the Beis Hamikdash. as we saw in last perek, David cannot be the one to build the Beis HaMikdash for the all the reasons that we saw, but there's nothing that, nowhere did it say you cannot take preparatory steps, gather the materials. So we're already seeing that when David goes to battle and he brings back spoils, he's devoting those spoils to the Beis HaMikdash.
But isn't that odd that the spoils of war is used for the Beis HaMikdash, and then David couldn't build the Beis HaMikdash because he was a man of war? Seems odd that that's what they used.
The shield, let's say, I don't know, maybe like the shields, you have to imagine that they get melted down, maybe.
But this is all spoils of the war.
See, I look at it the other way. I think it's a beautiful idea to take something that's more than what we need to consider.
Right. I hear the question. I hear the answer.
Well, someone else would do something like that.
Right. I don't know. We have to think about the question a little more. When we take the approach that David couldn't build the Beis HaMikdash because he had too much blood on his hands, and that person can't be involved in building the Beis HaMikdash, how does that relate to, well, you're taking items that were the spoils of said wars, and you're using those items to build the Beis HaMikdash? Maybe it's along the lines that we don't give too much significance to the inanimate objects as opposed to the person and what the person represents. That kind of, I'm not an artist, but I do believe that an artist puts themselves into their piece of art. I don't write music.
I'm not a musician,
but I appreciate that the person who creates. You know, that's why I usually like to, I'm just talking myself, I usually like to appreciate the person. And then if I appreciate the person, I appreciate their music a lot more because that's their creation. So it works in the opposite, that David was, because David was in his essence a man of war, he can't be the person to create the Beis HaMikdash, because in the creation will be, as opposed to the inanimate objects, they're inanimate. So if Shlomo melts down the shields and now it's gold to make the floor of the Beis HaMikdash, which, you know, or the ceiling, which was plated in gold, it could work. Or maybe you have to take the, you know, we did see some other reasons why David couldn't build the Beis HaMikdash. Maybe that has to be a little bit more primary. But if you look, you know, maybe we'll have a chance to see some of it. But in Divrei Yamim, there are a number of chapters devoted to David kind of gathering and the details of what he did, everything that he could to build the Beis HaMikdash, you know, save the actual building. We've already seen that he got the land for it, and he had the idea for it, and now he's beginning to collect materials. Pasuk Tes. Vayishma to'i melech Hamas. This is another city in the north called Hamas. Hamas, no relation to what the word means today. Vayishma To'i, the king of Hamas, whose name was To'i, he heard ki ka David es kol chel Hadadezer. He heard that, you know, one of his neighbors, Hadadezer, David had struck the whole force of his, of Hadadezer. And apparently, this king, To'i, he was not on good terms with Hadadezer. So, if you kill my enemy, then you're my friend. Pasuk Yud. Vayishlach To'i es Yoram beno el hamelech David. L'shalo l'shalom. So this To'i, the king, sent his son, whose name was Yoram, to David hamelech. L'shalo l'shalom, to wish him peace. Ulevarcho, and to greet him. Because he fought against Hadadezer and he was successful. Ki ish milchamos To'i haya Hadadezer. They were men of war together, To'i and Hadadezer, meaning they were adversaries. Uviado, and in the hands of this son named Yoram, uviado hayu klechesef, uchezav, uchlein, uchoshes, he brought with him silver vessels, gold vessels, copper vessels, as a tribute of peace to David. And Pasuket Aleph, Gam Osam Hikdish Hamelech David LaHashem. Im HaKesev HaZav Asher Hikdish Mikol HaGoyim Asher Kibish. So this pasuk is kind of, we're moving out of just Mefarshim saying it. This is explicit in the pasuk, where David sanctified these items. He made them hektish. A person has the power to take anything that they own and donate it to the cause of the mikdash. At this point, it's not the Beis HaMikdash, it's the Mishkan and its holy aspects. And so David was makdish. David sanctified these items, which you might say were personal items. These are not spoils of war. This is an extension, one leader to another leader giving gifts. But David doesn't want to keep them for personal purposes. Now, some of Farshim point out why he doesn't want to keep them for personal purposes, because it goes back to the same idea of the horses. You have to go back to Sefer Devar and Perakid Zion. Another one of the commands of the king is not to have too much money, not to have too much wealth. Again, most like first and foremost, because Hashem said so. The other is that people sometimes with a lot of money tend to put their faith in their large quantities of money as opposed to faith in God. So David took these seemingly personal items of Zav, Chesed, and Nechoshes, and he was makdish it to Hashem, which is understood as for the purposes of the Beis HaMikdash. What else is it going towards? And he did that im hakesef ha'azav asher hikdash mikol ha'goyim asher kibesh. It was part of the collection that David already had from all of the other nations, meaning what we were reading about. It says vayivim Yerushalayim, and he has the nechoshes harbei. So he was always being, every time he got, it sounds like every time he captured something in war, he was sanctifying it to God to eventually be used for the Beis HaMikdash. Pasuk Yud Beis. Me'aram u'mimo'av u'mnei Amon u'miplishtim u'me'amalek u'mishlal hadad Ezer ben Rechov melech Tzova. What are those lands that he conquered? Well, there's Aram, Moav, who are mi'bnei Amon, Plishtim, Amalek, and Hadad Ezer, who's Tzova. What's everybody's question? We heard about Aram, we heard about Moav, we heard about the Plishtim, and we heard about Tzova. Where's Amalek fitting in here? Where is there a battle with Amalek? So here there are some of Farshim who explain we have to go back in time. That when David was in Tziklag, when he was living with the Plishtim, with Achish, he was given a little place to live in called Tziklag. And he was going on David had to keep up the ruse that he's really on the side of the Plishtim. Mm-hmm. So he kept going out to attack Israelis, even though he wasn't. But he had to attack someone. And when he was spending those days attacking, a group of people who called themselves Amalek, and we had a whole discussion, could they really be Amalek, came and they captured all the children and the women, and they burnt down the city, and David had attacked them. So the Mefarshim explained, it's those spoils, which is, it's really quite amazing, because at that point, David's not king, and at that point, the future doesn't look so good, meaning he's still on the run from Shaul. David at that point has no idea that things are going to work. He has no idea that things are going to work out, but he has emuna, he has trust in Hashem that it will. And so according to that approach, you would say that David already from that time was saving spoils from the war, this battle with those people who were called Amalek, and he's saving it for Hashem, which is definitely nice. If you didn't want to take that approach, you would maybe say that somewhere along these battles, he came into a contact with people who call themselves Amalek. Again, whether they were DNA Amalek, so that is not so likely given everything that had happened in the time of Shaul, which is not that long ago. I mean, the battle, we have to imagine this is within the first couple of years that David is king. You want to call it within 5 years of David being king. We know that there's 7 years before he's the recognized king. So 12 years, and Shaul's king for 2 years before that, which means the war with Amalek happened sometime. So sometime in the last 20 years was the war with Amalek. You can't. It's hard to say that they amassed themselves back up again. But it could just be that people took their name and other nomadic tribes. And
you always take the spoils of war, correct or incorrect?
Unless otherwise told. I mean, there were some instances in Tanakh where specifically by
in a way,
by Yericho.
In a way, or maybe just a roll of spoils of war that you take.
A lot of times they're personal. A lot of times they're personal, and some we have instances in the Torah where the spoil, specifically the war against Midian, where things were divided equally amongst those who went to war, among the ones who didn't, and then they were able to be used for personal purposes. But David seemingly did not. And again, where this Amalek fits in, you either have to go back to the original Amalek, or you have to work around to explain why Amalek got into this list. Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayas David Shem b'shuvom ha'koso es Aram. Begay Melach, 18,000. David had made for himself a name, as the Metzudas David says, Asa Gvura Gdola, the Kana Shem. He did things of great strength, and therefore he acquired a name. Meaning, when you make a name for yourself, so now some of the other nations that were not even hearing their names, the bordering nations, they're hearing who David is. They're hearing how he's so successful in war, and when you get such a name for yourself, people are going to want to stay away from you. Now it specifically mentions a battle against Aram in a place called Gemelech, the Valley of Salt. The only problem here that the Valley of Salt is much more south, and it's actually located. Based on other psukim in Tanakh, it's located in the land of Edom, much, much, much further south. So what's going on with the? And it says that he killed 18,000. So presumably this was based on some other psukim in Tanakh. I don't know what number we're up to, but this is a separate battle. After having fought with Aram, he fought another battle in a place called Gemelach, and there were 18,000 there were 18,000 killed, and this battle was considered to be the crowning, you would call it the crowning achievement of David's recent military pursuits. And so this the pasuk here goes out of its way to say, and this is how he got his renown. It was kind of like in every possible direction where David extended himself, he was successful militarily, and so that's the name that's going around. David's successful in the southeast, he's successful in the north, he's successful in the west, he's successful even in this place called Gemelach, and so that's David's success. And it seems to be this is not a battle against Aram, but against the people of Edom, so it's another nation state, Pasuk Yudalid. Vayasam be'Edom Nitzivim, he set up in Edom, again he set up officers, b'chol Edom, in all of Edom, some nitzavim, he set up these officers, the double language, so some of Farshim understand that he was constantly sending new officers to be in control of the land. Vayhi kol Edom avadim l'David, all of Edom are servants to David. Vayosha Hashem as David, b'chol asher halach, and Hashem provides salvation for David in every way that he went. You'll recall Edom usually is understood as the descendants of Esav, and when Esav gets his bracha from Yitzchak, the bracha basically is that the nevuah that Rivka receives when she was pregnant with the two sons is that there's going to be a seesaw, that when Esav is high, Yaakov is low, and when Yaakov is high, Esav is low. This is the time period in Jewish history, perhaps, where Klal Yisrael is on the highest level that they're ever on. So it's to see that Edom is now subjugated in the hands of David. That's very significant. And Pasuk Tezvav, Vayimloch David al kol Yisrael. David reigned over all Yisrael to the extent that now he's much more solid as king because there's so much more protection. There's so much more security in the land. Vayhi David oseh mishpat utzdaka l'chol amo. And David was someone who did mishpat and tzedaka for the entire people. Mishpat and tzedaka usually do not go together. Mishpat is justice, judgment, and tzedaka is kindness and righteousness, charity. How do you do both? So the average person can't do both. David's greatness is that he was able to do both, that he was able to extend mishpat, he was able to extend tzedaka. Some quote, there's a chazal that explains that he was, we know that a king can also be a judge. A person can have a choice to go to a human court, the regular court, judged by the rules and regulations of Beis Din. You could also go to the king. You can go to the king for judgment. As we'll see, other hints, the fact that many people would come to David for judgment. David, when he judged a case, he judged it based on strict mishpat, that even if a poor person was standing in front of him and he thought the poor person was deserved to have to owe money to someone else, he went with that strict justice, and then he had a servant run after him and pay, give the poor person money so that he'd be able to pay. So he was mishpat and tzedaka at the same time. The Gemara mentions an idea that where do mishpat and tzedaka reach themselves? That pushing for compromise. That every time, anytime you have people fighting over, let's just say a classic Din Torah, if they're fighting over money, if you can bring the people to compromise, so on the one hand, that's mishpat, because if everyone agrees to it, then it's justice. On the other hand, it's also tzedakah, it's also righteousness, because everyone's going to walk away in agreement. And if everyone's in an agreement, so that's many times the approach of trying to get people to compromise, that's the role of the dayan, that's the role of the judge. And that perhaps that's also David was able to encourage that as much as possible. The Perek concludes the last couple of psukim. David mentions his most significant officers. Pasuk Tes Zayin. These are not officers like we mentioned that each of the nation states had officers. These are the national. This is the federal government. V'Yoav ben Tsruya al Hatzava. This is not a surprise to us. Yoav ben Tsruya, David's nephew, was in charge of the army. There's some of Farshim who see a connection that the pasuk starts with the word vav, meaning it's a little strange. Had you been talking about in the previous pasuk some other national officers, so then you could begin this pasuk with vav. But if you're only starting a list, you don't start a list with the letter vav. So why is it with the letter vav? So that the vav achibur, so that the vav connects to the previous pasuk. That why was Yoav able to be the successful general in battle? Because David was in the previous pasuk. David was the osem mishpat utzdaka. And why was David able to have peace of mind to be osem mishpat utzdaka? Because Yoav was in charge of while Yoav, as we have seen and will continue to see, Yoav is probably the most, my humble opinion, the most complex character in Sefer Shmuel. I guess could be up there with Shaul, but he for much of Yoav's time, he was a very proper individual to be in charge of the army, and it went hand in hand with David's mishpat utzdaka. Pasuk Tazayin continues, V'Yehoshaphat ben Achilud Mazkir. Someone named Yehoshaphat, the son of Achilud, was the Mazkir. The Mazkir, the Metzudas David defines it as the one who would keep the book of remembrances of the king. It's some, Rashi says a little more of a different type of secretarial position, that this is the one who would announce what appointment the king is up to, right? There's no Siri that time. You have to have who's keeping your calendar. So Yehoshaphat was some type of chronicler, that's how the Art Scroll translates it, some type of administrative secretarial, right, the national secretary. Pasuk Yud Zayin, V'tzadok ben Achituv, V'achimelech ben Evyasar, Kohanim, they were the priests, Usiraya Sofer, and Siraya was considered to be the Sofer, the scribe. Who are these Kohanim? So there is the Mefarshim explained that Tzadok became the eventual Kohen Gadol, Tzadok ben Achitov, and Achimelech ben Avyasar was the assistant Kohen Gadol. But that all happens a little bit more in the future. Some of these positions here, as we'll see, the last pasuk mentions how David's sons are officers, right? If we're doing the math, we all know when David's sons were born. They can't exactly, how old could they possibly? They could be, at most, they're 12 years old now. They're not national officers in the army, even though parentheses, his son who becomes king at age 12. But that's in the future. So right now, there was a different Kohen Gadol. The Kohen Gadol was Evyasar. Evyasar was the one Kohen who survived from the city of Nov, who had run away and came to David and wore the ephod. He was the son of the Kohen Gadol. At some point, the position of Kohen Gadol switched. Why did it switch? So now you have to review. We have to go all the way back to Perek, Beis and Gimel of Shmuel Aleph. That the Kohen Gadol was Eli. Eli was the Kohen Gadol, and he had sons who weren't proper, and Eli was punished. What was Eli punished? Eli was punished that he was going to lose his position of power, meaning he was going to lose, his family was going to lose having the position of Kohen Gadol. There were Aaron originally had four sons. Two sons, Nadav and Avihu, unfortunately died on the day that the Mishkan was inaugurated. That's Parshas Achrimos and Shmini. So after Pesach stuff. And then there were two sons left. There was Elazar and Isamar. Elazar, Itamar, however you want to say it. Elazar became the Kohen Gadol that the Torah tells us in Parshas Chukas. When Aaron passes away, Elazar becomes the Kohen Gadol. Elazar's son is Pinchas. Pinchas, the famous Pinchas, also became Kohen Gadol. Pinchas was Kohen Gadol. Pinchas lived a very long time. And Pinchas was the Kohen Gadol during, in Sefer Shoftim, when there was a civil war, the story of Pelegesh Begiva, and the tribe of Binyamin was almost wiped out. So the position of Kohen Gadol was taken away from Pinchas' family as a punishment, because Pinchas perhaps didn't do enough to hold back a civil war from happening. And so Pinchas, who came from the line of Elazar, that family lost the Kohen Gadol, and it went to the side of Isamar, to Aaron's son Isamar. Eventually, Eli is from that family. Eli is the Kohen Gadol. But Eli was punished that his family would lose the position of Kohen Gadol. Towards the end of David's time, and we'll see it together, Evyasar, who came from the line of Eli, who's from Isamar, lost the position of Kohen Gadol, and it shifted to this Tzadok ben Achitov, who came from the line of Elazar. And so the position of Kohuna Gedola finally went back to its original place. So that's why these Kohanim are mentioned. Evyasar, we already heard about, that's why he's not mentioned. And the final Pasuk mentions, Pasuk Yeches, Uvenayahu ben Yehoyada, Benayahu ben Yehoyada, Vakresi Vaplesi, which is understood as he's in charge of the Kresi and the Plesi. Who are the Kresi and the Plesi? The Kresi and the Plesi are literally translated as the archers and the slingers. But the Chazal understand that Kresi and Plesi refers actually to the Sanhedrin and to the Urim Vetumim. That the word karas means to cut, to be clear, to have clear-cut decisions. And the word placey comes from the word mufla, which means distinguished or special. And that it was Benayahu ben Yehoyada was the head of the Sanhedrin. And he was also in charge of deciding and helping David decide which questions would be asked to the Urim V'tumim. So Benayahu ben Yehoyada was considered to be the religious, one of the religious leaders of the time. And the parak concludes by telling us again, at some point in the future, when they were age appropriate, Ubnei David Kohanim Hayu. The sons of David were Kohanim. Here, obviously, the word Kohanim cannot be referred to as priests, because we know that David comes from the tribe of Yehuda. And David never, although there were, you know, different times in history where people tried to take identities of other tribes. Right? We had Kohanim in the time of Hanukkah taking the position of king. David wasn't trying to extend himself. Metzudos Tzion defines Kohanim can also mean Roshim, Vesarim. It can mean officers, also ministers. And so at some point, David incorporated his own sons to be from the ministers of the country. That's how the Targum Yonasan translates it as Ravravin. Ravravin sounds like it's an Aramaic word that means more like officials. So this perek is about David expanding his empire and solidifying the empire by having national officers in charge of various things. So Be'ez Hashem, after Pesach, we will continue with the next perek.